Vectis Radio on DAB.
Welcome to Maggie Talks To, a series of in-depth conversations with people who live and work here on the Isle of Wight. I'm here with the legend that is Paul Armfield, and we're going to be asking him a few questions. Hello, Paul.
Hello, legend. Legend, as they say. Yes.
And how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Yeah.
Good. So I'm going to ask you a few questions, but most of it is organic, so
okay.
I haven't got a list of questions. So were you actually born here on the island?
No, I was born in Birmingham and lived there till I was 10.
So you went to school up there in the beginning?
Yeah, at the beginning. And interestingly, when I was at school in Birmingham, I was bottom of the class and really with not much interest in anything school-wise. And then we moved to the island, and the first lesson we did, I went to Ventnor Middle School, and the first lesson we did, I came top of the class.
Wow.
And I was, what's going on? This is a bit odd. And what had happened was I'd gone from being the youngest in the class to being the oldest. So I'd gone back a year, in effect. So, a second chance, really. You know, if I'd have, because I was just heading in Birmingham, I was just heading for the 11 plus. So, you know, the course of my life would have been very, very different.
Yeah.
So I'm all for second chances.
Absolutely. So where did you go after middle school?
After middle school, I went to Medina High School. And, I was never, I was not indifferent about school, but I sort of quite enjoyed the social element of school, I suppose.
Yeah.
I was only years later, really, that I realised that actually I'm not academic, because I always thought I was quite bright, and I am bright, but, you know, my results never fulfilled my promise, you know, my academic results. So, I'm just reading through all my reports. Oh, Paul's got so much possibility if he only put his mind to it. But, you know, latterly I sort of think, you know, I've probably... ADHD or whatever, you know, whatever people like to diagnose it as. And just, yeah, although I can think on my feet and was good in the classroom on paper, it took me a lot longer, as it still does, to order my thoughts.
I can understand that, yeah. So whilst you were at school, did you have any idea what it was you wanted to do when you left?
It was always art and music, really. That was the thing. I loved books and loved reading, but it was music and art. I was the only thing I ever, before I came to the island, the only thing I showed any propensity for was for art, you know.
Yeah.
And
was
I should
any form of art, painting, sculpture?
Well, I started off just copying Marvel comics. Just doing destroyed superheroes, you know, and then I was very lucky to meet some people in Ventnor, some good friends in Ventnor who came from a very artistic family, and they very much opened my eyes to all sorts of possibilities but music was always my thing, you know. Ever since I can remember, I just used to spend a large portion of my time just playing records, and so that music was always a thing. And then when I moved to the island, I started playing. I'd had a few guitar lessons in Birmingham, and then moved to the island. And because I had asthma, they were recommended that, you know, we people with asthma learn a wind instrument.
Right.
So I was given the French horn to play, which again I could make sound lovely, but it was the application, you know, the sitting down and learning to read music. And also I was sent to the Isle of Wight orchestra, the youth orchestra, because I didn't know anyone and no one told me anything, I just turned up and on a Saturday morning, which was the most grueling thing. I lived in Ventnor, it was the first stop on the bus, and the bus went all around the island to pick up people before getting there. So I had to get on really early to get there, didn't know anyone, very unconfident in my abilities as a horn player, and went to the older orchestra by accident, because no one said there were two orchestras, no one gave me any guidance, or, you know, just arrived there and dumped myself down, couldn't read anything I was given. It was way beyond my abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I just sat there feeling like an idiot every week, you know, and dreading them saying, oh, can we just hear from the horn section? And so I did one concert with them. And even then, again, I remember we'd been on holiday and we arrived back and I knew I'd got a concert, but nobody, there'd been no communication because I was in the wrong orchestra, of course. So they weren't sent, they'd got my details. And I turned up and everyone was wearing white shirts and I was wearing a grey shirt. So I stood out like a sore thumb. Yeah, yeah. So it put me off for life, really, that sort of playing. But at that same time, I was me and some friends had decided to form a punk band.
As you do.
I was about 12, and we didn't have the instruments, and we decided which instruments we were going to play, and you know, pestered our parents till we got them, and then just went from there. And honestly, within probably 6 months, we were gigging. And
what did you call yourselves?
Well. We had all sorts of names. My favourite was Brain Explosion. But I can't remember what name we played under when we performed. It might have been Catch 22, but I can't remember. I can't remember what name we performed under. We only did two or three gigs on the island, you know. I was entrepreneurial in that I was always happy. I never thought of reasons why you couldn't do stuff. I just went and did it. Let's do a gig. So I went and hired the hall, painted a backdrop and, you know, sorted out a PA and made tickets and advertised it, you know. And all with, you know, just fearless, really, you know, the fearlessness of youth and just did that. And quite often I'd do it, you know, for things at school as well. I'd, you know, organise parties for us all. And, you know, I was all organising gigs and promoting gigs and, not even thinking I was doing anything, you know. I'd just do it, you know, without any thought. But it was the, you know, certainly I don't know if it was entrepreneurial spirit necessarily, but certainly just, you know, a willingness to just get on with stuff and make it happen. You know, not waiting around saying, oh, you know, complaining we ain't got any venues to play. I'd go out and find a venue.
Yeah.
You know,
and, so were they successful gigs?
Not really, you know. Well, they were successful in as that, you know, people came to see, our friends came to see us play and stuff like that. But then I left that band and formed a trio with my friend's brother and his mate. And we were doing more sort of goth stuff, I suppose.
Right.
And then I left them and formed Bobby Ock and Fly.
Yes.
At the same time as I started playing with JC as well in the what was then, they were the Chuff Train Stompers that they just started. So both sort of bands started at similar times and I was playing with both of them, Bobby Ock and Fly and the Chuff Train Stompers, which was fun, but then just shifted over to the, you know, Bobby Ock and Fly.
Yeah. And that was very successful, wasn't it?
Yeah. And again, from, you know, because we had a can-do spirit, you know, and we loved it and we were just, we'd get together three times a week and, you know, the band were all over the island. Dave was in Cowes and, you know, and we rehearsed in Ventnor. And we were very lucky in that I worked at the Royal Hotel, again, since I was 12, I'd had a job. And the Royal Hotel was, the back of Royal Hotel was the nightclub, Julissa's.
Right.
Which was a fantastic place. And I used to be able to go there when I was sort of 16, you know, because we, you know, I worked at the hotel, and then when I was about 18, they closed down for good, and it was just damp and, you know, and a bit grubby in there. But they let us rehearse there, and it was soundproofed, so we could just do what we like there, and we kept it as our headquarters. So we'd leave all the equipment there, which probably in hindsight was not a great thing because it would get damp, you know, and. but it was brilliant. It was our den, you know. And we'd rehearse there three times a week, and we just play lots, and we did loads of, you know, smart things, like, you know, the car boot stickers that we produced that spread the name because everyone was like, "What's Bobby Ock and Fly?" You know, and you saw these, and it was good. Just, and I think just people appreciated. I mean, obviously the music was good. Duncan wrote such amazing songs. And, but none of us were really great musicians, but we worked at it, you know.
Yeah. And, so when did you learn to play the double bass?
I played a little bit at Medina High School, you know, because, oh, you're a bass player. We need a bass player in the orchestra. And so I'd go and do it, you know, but not much. But then it was a few years later, it was after in my 30s, when I'd always wanted a double bass, you know, but couldn't really afford them. But I went to, I saw one in Ryde, and it was affordable. And I told my wife, and lo and behold, she bought it me for Christmas.
Aww.
Yeah. So that was when I started playing double bass. Yeah, so I got a double bass, and not longer after I'd got one, we formed Cigani, the gypsy jazz band.
Right.
Me, Donal, and John Mansell, who interestingly was one of my first teachers at Ventnor Middle School.
Oh.
And we became very good friends you know, years later. And then JC took John's place. And then the Dance Preachers formed out of the Chuff Train Stompers, really. And so, I became the bass player with them as well.
So how did you learn the double bass, or did you just teach yourself?
Just taught myself. I mean, one of the things I just taught myself and learned, you know, made lots of mistakes. And you know, I'm not a great double bass player by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I'm barely competent on it. But my hero, the reason I wanted to play double bass, and a lot of double bass players like this, was Danny Thompson, who played with Pentangle, and, you know, but played on so many great records that I loved in the 80s, Kate Bush and everything but the girl he played with, and David Sylvian, particular David Sylvian album, which is, I mean, he's all over and it's fantastic. And I got wind that he was, that there was a bluegrass course called Sore Fingers that takes place in the Cotswolds. And they rent out they take over this whole big old school in the Easter holidays, and they bring amazing players from all over the world, actually. A lot of Americans teaching banjo and slide guitar and, you know, mandolin and all sorts of things, and fiddle. And they said, oh, somebody told me, Danny Thompson's doing the double bass. So it was about £120 for a week with Danny Thompson. So I spent a week
saved
with him.
Saved up your pennies.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I mean, it was a fantastic opportunity. Gave me a few pointers of the things I was doing wrong.
Yeah. But then you always got to learn, haven't you?
Always, yeah. But I'm not ambitious as a musician, you see. The thing is, I just like being in the band, and as a bass player, I just like, you know, I like sort of being in the background and just, yeah, sort of serving the song, serving the music. And I've never wanted to be, you know, I've never been interested in soloing, you know. And
no.
It's only when I play with JC that he insists, you know, do a solo. And, you know, there's an element of danger, I think, which makes it quite exciting because I don't know what I'm doing. But and similarly with guitar, you know, I only want to do enough just to accompany myself. I just don't have the application to, you know, to sort of put myself.
So when did you learn to play the guitar?
That just came as an extension of playing bass, really. You know, four strings to six strings, and
right.
I mean, it wasn't even four strings when I started. I started playing bass on a nylon strung guitar that only had about three strings left on it. You know, so but you know, it's just that's just evolved over the years, really. I don't think I've ever learned anything.
So you were working at the Royal from the time you were 12. And then you've joined a couple of bands. What happened next?
Well, Bobby Ock and Fly looked like they were doing quite well. And so I left. When I left school, I didn't go to university. So when I left school, Bobby Ock and Fly were, you know, in our prime. And so I thought it would be daft to sort of pack that in and go to university.
So you were quite young then when you started that?
18. I started when we were 16.
Right.
Then when I left school, I was 18. And the others were, I was the youngest in the band, actually. And so I hung around, and was just doing music. I should have gone to art school. I should have done, really. But actually, I don't think I was probably emotionally mature enough at the time. But anyway, wanted to stay around and just give the band a chance. You know, we thought it looked like we might have some success. There were some sniffs from industry and stuff. And then, of course, you know, you need to. They don't like it. Just they were really clamping down on unemployment, and so
right.
You know, I was forced to get a job, and that's when I got the job. Firstly at the Key Arts with Independent Arts with Carol Martis, who's recently died, sadly, but she'd started Independent Arts there, and I was one of the first staff there. So that happened, and then that really diverted my life in a completely different direction. So I ended up going down because they were providing entertainment to in old people's homes, in Polars, you know, the home for the blind, other sort of residential homes for, you know, all sorts of conditions across the island. And from there, I ended up getting a job as a Churchview Day Centre in Ventnor when they were releasing all the mentally ill from Whitecroft, as it was, into the community. They set up these day centres. So there was a day centre in Ventnor where I ended up getting a job just spending the day with people who, you know, were struggling one way or another. We would do, try and give them some routine, some activities. We cook dinner with them and things like that. And I did that for a couple of years. And then people said, oh, you should go and be a social worker. You know, you know, and I thought, I don't want to be a social worker, but maybe it's time to go to university.
We'll come back in a moment. We've got some adverts. So that's absolutely very interesting. And we'll come back in a few moments after the adverts.
Vectis Radio on DAB.
Right, we're back here with Paul Armfield again and with his fascinating story. You're going to become a social worker, apparently.
Well, no, that's what people were saying, you know, I should go and do, and I didn't want to. I thought, no, I don't want to do this. I enjoy the job, but it's not my calling. And so I thought, but I should go to university. You know, I should continue my studies. Again, at this point, still not realising that I wasn't academic. And also no one in my family had been to university. You know, I'm an only child, and no one had been, you know, followed that route or had any experience. So I didn't know what to do. And so I just applied randomly for various things and ended up studying communication at what was then Dorset Institute of Higher Education, and then became Dorset Poly, and then by the time I started, between my application and me starting, became Bournemouth University.
Right.
And so I ended up at Bournemouth University doing communication, which was everything from psychology, interpersonal psychology, to mass media and literature, right, and poetry. And,
yeah.
And I didn't enjoy it. I really didn't enjoy it. I was really uncomfortable in myself, and not confident, and found the work hard. Again, and, you know, later I know I'm academic, you know, and I can do these things, but it takes me a long time.
Yeah.
And just applying myself to it is really, really difficult. And the only thing I really enjoyed there was there was a poetry. The guy took us from poetry, a chap called Owen Davis from Swanage. And he was such a lovely chap, and we really hit it off. And I had a car there, which was my saving grace, because although I didn't enjoy Bournemouth, I enjoyed being in Dorset and the surroundings. So he would just take me off and show me all these lovely places around Dorset.
Yeah.
We had a lovely time. And that was what I enjoyed the most. And I met up with a few musicians outside of there, a couple of jazz musicians, and we started to do something. But, you know, I wasn't, my heart wasn't in it. Anyway, I just hit a real low. I went back for the second year, and just really it confirmed, you know, that I was just how uncomfortable I was with it. And I was hit rock bottom, really, and I left. I sort of walked out in one at the end, sort of after being going back for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And it was end of October, and I didn't know what to do. I came back to the island in tears, just not knowing what I was doing. And
so how old were you then?
I was 20, 23, somewhere around there. And I didn't know what to do. And my friend had finished university and he'd gone off traveling around Europe looking for jobs because he decided he wanted to be an English teacher.
Right.
And the only place he could get a job without a teaching qualification was Czechoslovakia, where they'd recently had a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And they were crying out for English teachers. And he'd gone there and was having a whale of a time. So I just sent him a letter saying, could you get me a job? And he said, yeah. And so I left university at the end of October. I moved up to Egham with a friend of mine, where he was living, and I got a job. I went up on the Friday, got a job on the Saturday, two jobs. I got a job at the Debenhams in the daytime and a job in the cinema at night. So just got some money, worked every day, every night, and just got enough money to slept on his floor and to save up and pay off my debts, you know, and student loan, the debts that I'd obviously, you know, and then went to Slovakia in the January. And it was Czechoslovakia then, but I went to Bratislava and lived there for 2 years, and it was the best thing I ever did. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
They just had it. It was a fresh start for them. It was a fresh start for me. You know, they just had the revolution, the Velvet Revolution. And while I was there, they split from the Czech Republic, and it was just a fascinating, brilliant, brilliant time to be there.
And the students were good?
Oh, they were fantastic. I mean, I was a terrible teacher. In fact, I went back a few years ago, and the head teacher, she said, I never told you this at the time, but I came past your classroom one day and I poked my head in the door and you were asleep, and all the students all turned to me and went, shh. that wasn't a regular thing, but occasionally, you know, the class would be after dinner. You could tell they're all tired, and I said, let's just have a little rest. But it was brilliant, and the kids were fantastic, and actually one of them remained a good friend, actually. That was brilliant. I had a fantastic time there. I didn't really do any music. I had my guitar there. I started writing songs, a few songs there.
Right.
That some of which went on to the first album in a, one form or other. But it was a marvellous time. And then I came back one summer and met Gina, my wife, on a one-night stand. And it turned out to be something more than that. So I went back and finished my time there and thought, no, you know, I've got to go back at some point and start a new life. And I came back to the Isle of Wight and didn't have a job. And within a few months, actually, I'd applied for a job it had just opened, Ottica's.
Yeah.
The bookshop had just opened.
Yeah.
And I got a job there, and yeah.
Bob's your uncle. I imagine you and Gina got married then.
Yes, we got married, had children, and that was my life, you know, selling books and young family. It was brilliant, and I was playing music. I was playing with at that point, I think, yeah, it was Sigarni and the Dance Preachers, and also I was playing with some other friends as well, Adam Kirk. One of them, Adam Kirk, who was at that time he'd been up to Leeds to study. He was a bit younger than me, and he'd been up to Leeds and ended up playing with Tanita Tikaram at the time, and then a wonderful singer called Sinead Lohan, and then and a wonderful band called the Bronte Brothers, typical Leeds, Yorkshire, brilliant name for a band. And then he ended up playing with Joan Baez and as her accompanist, which was fantastic. But he would come back. He's a fantastic musician and with great ideas, very tasteful. And he would come back between tours, and we would sit and write songs together. And he was really instrumental in, you know, getting me to write songs, a particular type of song, you know, and he really sort of directed what I was doing, actually.
Yeah.
And we came up with some...
Did you need that direction?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I needed that opportunity, for one, but also somebody with a bit of taste and a bit of, just could see the potential.
Yeah.
You know, what I was doing. And we did some four-track recordings. He got a four-track cassette player and a nice sort of little studio set up. We'd come up with an idea at the weekend. Then he'd spend the week and just flesh out this idea and come up with this brilliant backing. Then I'd go and do with some lyrics and do a vocal. And we came up with some wonderful, wonderful songs together. And those early demos are what caught the ear of someone and what ended up with me getting a record deal, basically.
Who was that?
That was a chap on the island called Mark Little, who was, you know, a bit of a scallywag. But, you know, had real connections within the music industry and very good at making things happen and opening doors. And so he said he heard it and said, oh, no, we've got to do this. And within a few weeks, we were recording at Adam had moved to the States at this point and he's still there. And so when I had the chance to go record in Island Records, the studio where Nick Drake recorded, Cat Stevens and Bob Marley and everyone, I put together a collection of my favourite musicians, which included JC and JC Grimshaw, Jake Rodriguez, who brought their eccentricities with them, you know, and their unusual, their mastery of lots of interesting, unusual instruments, including accordion, slide guitar, you know, a mandolin, harmonica. And as well as guitar, obviously, and Barclay Mackay, who I was at school with, who was now living in Leeds, but a fantastic pianist, keyboard player. I was really impressed with what I'd heard him doing. He was a fantastic Hammond player. And my friend Trevor, who I played with in a holiday camp band, which I've not mentioned, at Gurnard Bynes for a season. And although we hated that, we became close friends.
Why did you hate it?
Oh, it was not the music we wanted to be doing, really.
Right.
And you'd play to an audience that would...
Wasn't interested.
Well, you'd think weren't interested, but at the end of the night, they'd come and say, oh, best band I've ever heard. And you had no response from them all night. So it was a little bit demoralising, but the money was good.
Yeah.
But like I say, the saving grace of it was I met my friend Trevor, who became my closest friend. In fact, I was up last weekend in Beckenham for the 21st birthday of his son, who's my godson. But Trev sadly died a couple of years ago, which was terribly sad. But he was a fantastic musician who played with Level 42. He played with Divine Comedy. An incredible player,
yeah.
but an even better teacher. He became latterly a fantastic teacher.
So did you soak up all this instruction from people?
Well, the thing was, it was my baby. It was my idea, and I did feel there was a huge element of risk. Because the people I was working with, I wasn't sure, never quite sure where the money was coming from or what was happening, you know, or that the money would show up. So I just made sure that everyone got paid, all the other musicians got paid, and we went to the studio, spent a brilliant week. We rehearsed for a day and then went in the studio and basically recorded the album. And they were just such incredible musicians. And they did exactly what I knew they could do. And my, you know, guidance for them always was let's just go take it slower and, you know, let's do less. And so I was, you know, I was the producer, really, and they were my songs. But together it was just became a wonderful thing. Yeah, yeah.
So when you started writing songs, did you have any particular subject in mind or something that popped out of your head?
No, I was interested in words and how words sound, and that was the thing. And I was listening to all sorts of things. So I was listening to French chanson, which was always at the heart of what I did to some extent. But also at that time, I was probably listening to quite a bit of Americana, I suppose. I suppose it would be called Americana, but also to listening to sort of country. There was a lot of good, interesting country music coming out. People like John Prine and things like that. So, that was you know, who were and Lyle Lovett and people that were being playful with, you know, the language.
Yeah. Right, we can have another advert break. We'll be back with you in a minute.
Okay.
Vectis Radio on DAB.
We're now back with Paul Armfield. Now, Paul, where were we?
Well, I just recorded the first album. Yes. Yeah.
And what was your album called, this first album you recorded?
The first album was Songs Without Words, which was, you know, it was obviously very wordy.
Yes.
So it was a bit of a joke.
Yeah.
But we did that album, then we did another album. And at that, also at that point, what happened was that again, Mark had opened some brilliant doors. The record was released on a German, on his own imprint, but from a German label, a rap label. So it people weren't expecting this record, you know. And actually in Germany, it got lots of really incredible attention that I didn't really appreciate at the time, not knowing the German market. But we ended up with a really wonderful 5-page feature in this, their biggest magazine there. And I ended up with probably, well, he's a legendary promoter, a chap called Bertolt Seliger, as my promoter. And so, I mean, I was really dealt a fantastic deal at that point, you know. And we did a couple of amazing tours of Germany as a band, you know. I played some incredible places and got lots of really good press. And actually, the other day, clearing out the loft, and I found this tape player that I didn't know would work, and it worked. And the one cassette the first cassette I put into play was a cassette I never heard, and it was a recording, the radio recording of the very last concert we did, which we flew over to do a festival in Nuremberg in the ruins of this old church. And it was fantastic. It was broadcast on national radio, and I'd never heard it. And I listened to the cassette, and it was the hairs on my body were just standing up. It was electric, actually. It was a fantastic recording. But that was, you know, that was... It was 21 years old.
Yeah. Mm. And you were still working at Otterkes?
Still working at Otterkes. So brilliantly, my life, Otterkes was such a fantastic company to work for. When that first album came out, the MD, James Hennage, I never played it to him, but he heard a copy of the record before it came out. And he said, I've just heard your record. We've got to do something. It's fantastic. And he bought 1,000 copies, firm sale. And distributed it around the shops, and because, you know, what are they doing? We're a bookshop, what we're doing, selling music. He then paid from his own pocket for a two track free sampler to give to customers.
That's
for 10,000
nice.
Copies of. And I mean, that was incredible, and he was so unbelievably supportive. And so I from that, I was, you know, what that meant was that I was able to balance the two careers, you know, which was such an amazing thing, you know, and a young family.
Yeah.
You know? So I was able to do those two things, which was a dream come true, really, and it was perfect because all I ever wanted for music, really, I mean, I love playing with other people, but I also like performing on my own. But I is travel, and, you know, travel and meeting people. That's all I've got a poster in my toilet of the second tour we did, because it represents for me what I always saw as the measure of success. And the measure of success for me was, I always saw when you went to London or went to Paris or whatever, you'd see posters for bands. And I thought how wonderful it must be to arrive in a city and just see your face everywhere, yeah. You know. And I remember arriving in Vienna and just seeing my pictures, my face everywhere on this poster. And for me, that was it. You know, that was that was the height of success for me, and so I've been happy. You know, I was absolutely made up by that. And so since then, I mean, the things didn't, you know, because I couldn't, because although it was great and I was able to manage both, I didn't have a manager. I wasn't able to, I didn't have the wherewithal or the know-how really on my own to capitalize on that and move it forward. Yeah. And we'd had a little bit of a fallout with the band, with one of the members of the band. So that had sort of, we never pursued that anymore as a band. But then I did some more recording with Rupert Brown in Ride.
Yeah.
Recorded a few songs, and Adam was back, and JC. And then I did another few songs 6 months later because, you know, I'd got a young family and a job. So
yeah.
It wasn't like I could devote much time to
it.
And it took, after about 2 years, we realised we got an album's worth of material. So that became the next record. And then I did the Tennyson album. And then, so all that time, then I was touring Europe on my own.
Yeah.
All with a small little outfit. And it was, you know, I really enjoyed it. I just, like I say, I loved the travel. And I loved meeting people. And it was just the perfect balance, really. But what it meant was, you know, my career didn't rise. My career sort of had a, you know, I'm just riding the ripples of that initial of that initial impetus.
Yeah.
So,
but you're still going. You're still doing tours.
Yep, still going, still doing tours.
And when did you learn to play the saw?
That was on this course where I went to play double bass with Danny Thompson. There were a couple of saw players on that course. And one of them gave me a few tips. And I thought, that's the perfect instrument for me because you haven't got to practice scales. You can just, you know, it's like whistling.
Yeah.
So once you've learned the basics, you can do it. And I always wanted an instrument that I could solo on. But like I say, I haven't got the sort of brain that understands that, the mechanics of music. So, so the saw was the perfect instrument for me.
So can you now read music? Have you learned? Or?
No. I can work things out slowly and certainly put a chord chart in front of me, you know, and I can play along and just, you know, do an eye. And I've got a good ear, so I can busk, you know, very, very, you know, done. You know, you could say play this and I'd work it out, you know. And that as a bass player, yes, there's not much I couldn't, you know, do to push, you know. But so I never really learned music properly.
No. Then you went off to Key Arts.
Yeah, well then what happened, of course, was Otica's got bought by Waterstones and I didn't enjoy that nearly as much. The Waterstones was felt like a really big family, you know, and Waterstones was very much a more impersonal experience. So I stuck that out, but was quite glad to leave. I stuck it out for 20 years, you know. I was the bookseller in that shop in Newport for 20 years, and was manager, of course. And then when I left, I took redundancy from there. In fact, that was actually fantastic. I was out in Germany doing a TV show, and it'd been a fantastic TV show. And I was really fairly unhappy at work. And I was thinking, when am I, you know, how am I going to get out of this? The only thing I can hope for is redundancy. And that's not going to happen. And while I was in Germany, I did this brilliant TV show. Phone rang, my boss, I'm really sorry, Paul. I know you're away, but I need to tell you, your job is up for redundancy. Yes. Clicking my heels together. So then just did music for a couple of years. And I did my Found album, which I recorded in the front room there. And I hated it. I mean, I loved doing the music. Well, it did drive me mad. But just that having to constantly promote yourself and you know, to try and make a success of it and to constantly telling people how wonderful you are and the constant rejection from, you know, trying to get gigs and things. And just the whole thing is really not very good for the soul. So I didn't really enjoy it that much. But I was in the middle of this Found project and a couple of guys from the board at the Key came and asked me if I'd want to be the manager. And I said, well, you know, I can't, you know, I'm working on this record and, you know, this is what I'm doing. And then they came back a while after the album was out and said, you know, the job's up again, would you apply for it? So I did and got the job. And I, you know, I the key had been there all through my life, all through my adult life. And, you know, from going there for school discos and so I was really happy to take it over. And it was a part-time job. It was a part-time pay, but, you know, I was getting paid, I think, 18 hours a week, but working 80.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind. I didn't begrudge it at all because I loved it and I really wanted to make it a success, you know, and I had a really strong vision of how it should be.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for what it's worth, I think, you know, with given what I had to work with, I think, we, you know, it was a success over that time. Gone, being asked to go back to Germany to do some recording. And I realised that in all the time I'd been at Key Arts, I hadn't done anything creative. And you know, that's not, well, if I'm not creative, it's, you know, I'm not in a happy place, really.
Yeah.
So, I decided to come back and gave them several months' notice and said, you know, I need to go and do some more creative, be more creative. So again, I ended up just doing music for a short while. Well, and then COVID hit and the job came up in Cowes for a bookshop.
Yeah.
At the bookshop. And it was only a couple of days a week. So it was the perfect thing. And I went for it. And next thing you know, I'm the manager. we're, you know, it's gone around again. So now I'm, you know, running the bookshop, but 3 days a week, and it's the perfect job. I love it. You know, it's perfect because I have completely free reign.
Yeah. And you have guests in to play in the evenings and stuff.
Absolutely.
Don't you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's brilliant. You know, I love it. I love it so much. And we have wonderful, and you know, one of the brilliant things about running a bookshop is, working in a bookshop, is that you have just great customers, you know, and I have a great team, and I think the shop's brilliant. I have the full support of the owners, and I get to do my music as well.
That can't be bad, can it?
No, so it's brilliant. I just wish I had more time because I as with everything, you know, well, once I do start something, I want to do it properly. And so yes. I end up, you know, giving a lot of time to that. And you know, last year I did a new album and I did the Trees project. I did the book project last year. And I did more touring than I've ever done last year, which was, you know, I was on the road for 2 months. And it was fantastic and I loved it. But, you know, and now what I didn't do last year was anything creative. I didn't write anything anyway. Right. I didn't write any music. I did lots of creative things.
So is there anything in your brain to do?
Yeah, creatively? Well, this morning I've been continuing a project because I don't really know what I want to write about at the moment. So I'm in a bit of a, have I got anything new to say? And if I sat down to write, I know something would come out. But at the moment, I don't really have the space for that. So what I'm doing, I'm working on... I've recorded in the past about and translated for several Jacques Brel songs, and on the first two albums contained two Jacques Brel songs, and I've often thought actually I should do something more with that and do a Jacques Brel album. So I've been waking up in the mornings. If I wake up early, I just come downstairs and work through. More so, I was working on one today. I love the act of translation because it's you know, it's, although my French is very, very, you know, is school level. there are some wonderful, you know, you can use Google Translate, or there are some websites where people have spoken about the songs or done their own, you know, literal translations. Yeah. But the art is to take them and read, you know, take them with the verbatim translation and then to try and stick as close to the original, but, you know, make it singable. And that's a lot of translations don't necessarily do that. You know, they just, but yes. Yeah, so.
So if you had any advice to give to people to go through their life and go wherever it is they want to go, what would you advise them to do? Go with their heart? Or?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe go with their heart. I mean, I've had a very lucky combination of opportunities arising, but there's people say there's no good luck, there's only opportunity meets preparation, you know, and I do believe that to some extent, but I also think, you know, I've had there's been a couple of instances in my life when I've been given a second chance, and I think that's really, really important to, you know, to have another crack at I would say, you know, that just have faith in that, you know, that things can turn out all right, you know, but you have to put the work in, and you know, so if you're doing something you enjoy, it's not light work.
Absolutely. And if you're not enjoying it,
yeah,
do something else.
Yeah. That's what I say, because like I say, when it wasn't that I wasn't enjoying, there's been a few times in my life where I've been in jobs where I don't particularly, you know, I wasn't necessarily happy, and I've got out, and it's been always been a good thing, you know. But I've had the luxury of failure, if you like.
Yeah, we've all been there. Mm. Thank you for that, Paul. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Have you got a favourite tune that we could play at the end of this?
Oh, crikey.
It could be one of yours, of course, or anybody else's, or...
What should I choose?
I don't know.
Crikey, there's so many. I love Going Out of My Head by Little Anthony and the Imperials. It's one of my favourite songs.
Okay.
Brenda Holloway, Every Little Bit Hurts.
Okay.
If you would like to hear this or any other of the conversations again, go to the Vectis Radio webpage, vectisradio.com, and you can find it amongst the podcasts.
Your support matters. We operate thanks to the support of local businesses. If you would like to advertise on Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, contact our team today. Marketing at vectisradio.fm.